classic from 1976, recorded live at Carnegie Hall, featuring Dexter Gordon and Johnny Griffin with Blues Up and Down. On piano, George Cables. On bass, Rufus Reed. And on drums, Eddie Gladden. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead, and we have a crammed program today, so let's get with it. The first stop we're making is in Haiti, where fresh protests have broken out, and they're becoming more and more intense as Haiti, as you know, has decided to side with the self-appointed interim president of Venezuela. And there are many Haitians who remember how important and how kind and how generous the Venezuelan government had been to Haiti. And they believe that Haiti's president, Jovenel Moïse, has decided to betray that history, and they're in the streets. We have as our guest a person who has joined us so many times talking about Haiti. This is his area of specialty. Kim Ives, investigative reporter, independent documentarian, and editor of the English language editions of Haiti Liberté, says that new mass protests in Haiti are linked to President Moïse's support of the U.S.-backed or would-be or wants-to-be new regime of Juan Guaido. Hello, how you doing, Kim?
Oh, doing great, Eutrice, and thanks for that introduction. Yeah, you summarized it well. It's such an irony that Washington is here, but they have these much smaller demonstrations against Maduro and much larger for him, and they don't report a peep. But now we see in Haiti, oh my goodness, the country is aflame against Jovenel Moïse. And again, Pompeo, not a word. Pence, not a word. Trump, not a word. No, this is the incredible, one of the great ironies of our time is just these glaring contradictions that we see. The people are hungry, especially due to the fact that the Trump administration slapped sanctions, or harsher sanctions, because, of course, this happened with our friend Obama as well, on Venezuela. This made it impossible for the National Bank of the Republic of Haiti to make payments to Venezuela. So the Petrocaribe program that you were referring to, this solidarity fund of close to $4 billion, which went to Haiti over the past decade, was stopped, and Haiti stopped having cheap oil. Now, oil is through the roof. The IMF is saying, hey, Haitian government, you got to stop subsidies. And, of course, we had a program here on Lead Stories about the uprising last July 6th, 7th, 8th, and how the people said, no way, you're not going to raise the prices 50% on petroleum products. So now we have this, I could say, it looks very much to me, after these many years of covering like the end game for the Jovenel Moïse government, unfortunately, the problem is that the opposition doesn't really have an alternative in place. The various opposition parties, the Lavalas family, the Petit Dessalines, the children of Dessalines, there's a front called the Democratic and Popular Sector, led by a guy called André Michel, a very articulate and outspoken lawyer, but has his own baggage. And so probably the result will be a U.S. embassy concocted junta of some sort, or government of some sort that will come in. But for sure, Haiti is definitely unraveling right now, and I really don't think Moise is going to be able to survive this spasm.
Do you believe, though, from what you've observed and what you've been reporting, that the opposition is strong enough to hold long enough to indicate that it isn't a slam dunk for Guaido in Venezuela going up against the president with the help of U.S. support? Do you think they'll hold out long enough to at least indicate it isn't a unanimous view that the U.S. imposed or U.S. supported effort in Venezuela to take over the government in Venezuela is going to go without regional support, some kind of regional support?
Yes, I think the Haitian, right now, when I say the opposition is weak, it doesn't mean among the people. This is like a giant body of the Haitian masses, which has risen up. There isn't really a head directing it. Everybody in the streets sees it. They're disgusted. They're outraged by this terrible slap, patasuel, as they would say in Creole, against the Venezuelan people, against Nicolas Maduro, against the memory of Hugo Chavez, with this betrayal, this knife in the back of the Venezuelans in fighting the Colossus to the north. So we are definitely going to see this rebellion continue, and basically the people are hungry, very, very terrible poverty, inflation, unemployment, you name it, in Haiti right now. So the people need a change. They just say, listen, we're not going to go on. And Jovenel Moise came to power on just this most outlandish promises, Utrice. I mean, you know, he said in 18 months, 2 years, everybody's going to have 24-hour electricity. And he said, I'm signing at the bottom of that. This is what's going to happen. And everybody was clapping. And, you know, he really just did a swan dive out into the nether regions with these crazy promises, which, if anything, things have gotten much worse. The blackouts are worse. The lack of gas, there are gas lines all over the place, a black market growing, food prices through the roof. So all this rosy picture that he was portraying has not just not arrived, but things have gotten much worse. So people are really, really fed up with this PHTK. I think, you know, the weakness in the opposition that I'm referring to will not reflect the Haitian people's rebellion. Even if they don't have the strength to put together a revolutionary government, which could, you know, lead Haiti down a different road at this moment. But nonetheless, the people's rebellion is going to continue.
So we have the common thread here of oil still, in a way, holding this uprising together, both mm-hmm. in Venezuela and in Haiti. How is that working in light of intense pressure to basically get at the oil and keep it, the U.S. Supported forces in Venezuela and the U.S. supported forces in Haiti?
Yeah, well, of course, and when Haiti Liberté published in 2011 the very first article in the series of articles we ran through 2011 and 12 and 13 based on 2,000 WikiLeaks WikiLeaked secret cables from the U.S. State Department. The very first one was basically the story of how the U.S. fought tooth and nail to keep Haiti from getting and signing a Petrocaribe deal with Venezuela. They were really opposed, even though this deal was such a boon for Haiti in terms of, remember, at the time, oil was at $100 a barrel. Of course, that's changed today. I always feel that the fact that the Saudis are pumping 1 million barrels extra every day onto the market has a lot to do with Washington's probably nudging them to do so, so as to weaken precisely Venezuela and Russia and some of its arch enemies. But the situation is that they've had to do this kind of warfare, economic warfare against Venezuela, the political warfare, of course, with setting up these Frankenstein monsters in the form of Juan Guaido, who's completely a product of the National Endowment for Democracy nursery, that they create these sort of fake leaders. Max Blumenthal and Dan Cohen on the Gray Zone Project have a wonderful piece showing all the U.S. government agency background of this Juan Guaido. So, you know, they create these fake governments, and they're going to do it now probably for Haiti. But, you know, it's not going to solve anything. The people are very clear, very, very clear on this U.S. agenda in Haiti, and that the embassy is no friend of theirs, and that the Venezuelan people and the Venezuelan revolution is and was. They're the ones who have put cash on the table. And it's not just the Haitian people that see that. In those same WikiLeaks documents, one of the ones we did was a U.S. ambassador from, I believe it was Argentina, and he said, you know, we're getting our butt kicked in Latin America because, you know, we come to these countries, we make promises of this program or that, and nothing happens, and yet here come the Venezuelans and the Cubans, and they deliver. They come and they give actual aid and no strings attached. We gotta rethink our policies. This was the U.S. ambassador. That's the irony of this situation, is that even though the U.S. is not willing to help Haiti or Venezuela, they're ready to mess them up and drive them into the ground.
So this is happening just as the national festival, known as Carnival, is about to take place in Haiti, right. Just like in Trinidad, mm-hmm. all kinds of political mayhem may be occurring, but you better not interfere with Carnival. Shoot. So
right.
Are we seeing anything like that where, in a way, Carnival, because now you're talking about the entire country being mobilized in these festivities, how would that fit into the protest against Moïse?
Well, mea culpa here. I think I have once again underestimated the militancy of the Haitian people, because I think in the last program I was with you, I was saying, well, probably the top is going to blow after Carnival, but here clearly it has beforehand. And, you know, at this point, a lot of the mayors are canceling Carnival activities in various towns. That's one. And then two, the government has given a massive amount of money for Carnival, following the old Julius Caesar formula, give them bread and circuses. So they were hoping, I think, that Carnival could act as that pressure release valve, and I thought probably that would work. It has in the past, historically, but clearly this year it did not. That February 7th was really the kickoff 5 days ago when the anniversary of Jean-Claude Duvalier's departure in 1986 took place. On February 7th, Jean-Claude Duvalier left Haiti. And so ever since, that has become the de facto day of celebrating democracy and the return of democracy. So that February 7th march, which I knew would be big, but I didn't know it would really kick off this period, which I don't see the end in sight. And the thing is, it becomes a vicious circle, Utrice, because for every demonstrator who is shot or killed, and the police are shooting live rounds at crowds. They're saying now the death toll is 4, but I think that's probably low. My guess is more people have died, and of course many have been wounded. And the thing is just going to continue to escalate because there's simply no way of putting this genie back in the bottle.
Well, let's take a look at how the region is responding. Mm-hmm. Since we last talked, how have things changed? We know that there is a lot of aid that is ready to pour into Venezuela. We know also that Venezuela is blocking that aid. The U.S., again, playing a major role in offering this aid and seeing to the transportation of aid outside of Venezuela coming into Venezuela. But Maduro has said that he will stop the aid for obvious reasons. Number one, there will be a huge political fallout in favor of Guaido as the self-appointed new president of Venezuela. He will get credit for that. But beyond that, there's also the matter of security. Under the guise of bringing in aid, they may also bring in other things like soldiers, like weapons, and other ways of disrupting life in Venezuela. How is it going?
Well, yes, I think it's right. He's in a damned if you do, damned if you don't situation where you stop the aid and people say, oh, you're stopping us getting food. But I think he's totally right. I think Maduro is absolutely making the right move because bringing it in, like you say, it's just going to be water to the mill of Guaido. They can bring in weapons and those sacks of rice or whatever they're bringing in. And, I think they just have to go on lockdown. The people, I've been impressed to see the size and the militancy and the determination of the demonstrations in support of Maduro. We had on one of our Haitian radio shows, Haiti Liberté has a Sunday afternoon show on one of the principal Haitian radio stations, and we had William Kamakaro from New York. You probably know him, Utrice, who is the head of the Bolivar in Circles up in New York. And he was giving a report from the ground, and it was very rousing. I mean, the people really see what they're up against, and I think Trump and Pence and Pompeo and even the globalists, the Clintons and the Obamas, et cetera, I think they've all really underestimated the Venezuelan people. And for sure, it's going to be bloody, and we don't have a crystal ball. I mean, when I say bloody, it's going to be a real fight to resist this offensive of the empire, but I think that so far Maduro has done a very good job. I don't know if you saw it, but this video he sent out, this message to the American people, was beautifully done, I thought. And this is just right. I think they're being smart. I think they have the determination, and stopping that aid coming in. Boy, if there was ever a Trojan horse, that was one.
Well, look, I mean, there is a great deal of upheaval, and all of it involving the two heads of state of the respective countries, Haiti and Venezuela. The people of Haiti want Moise out.
Right.
How is that going? They've gotten rid of his predecessor, now it's Moise's turn. They're very dissatisfied with his performance in office. How is that effort going in terms of parliamentary procedure and constitutional procedure?
Well, at this point, he's even his close allies, like in the Haitian parliament, there are many sort of mini Moises. These are totally corrupt politicians who are, as they say in Creole, j'cheche, completely shameless. You know, they'll lie to you straight face. One of the most archetypal examples is a fellow called Yuri Latortue. Again, we did a very long WikiLeaks article, actually two articles on Yuri Latortue, because even the embassy calls him a poster boy for political corruption and a mafia a chieftain. So even people like Yuri Latortue, who is very, he's a senator and one of the strongest senators in the parliament, is forsaking Moise. You know, he sees the rats are running from the ship. They're jumping overboard. And he's started his own movement, of protest against Moise, even though he was thick as thieves with him not long ago. So I think it's going to be, as we speak, as we're having this, I'm sure at the embassy and in the back rooms of power, or I should say of the dark power of the embassy and people like Yuri Latortue, they're sitting, cobbling, how are we going to do this? How are we going to, dress this up as something legitimate, because... they always try to put some, like when they ousted Aristide in 2004, they took like a three-step process. They made what they called a council of sages, right, of wise people. And so they took three people out of the blue. Of course, they had to get one kind of blah, blah, see, figure in there, a guy called Leslie Delatour, who was, Leslie Voltaire, who was basically opportunist of the 10th degree. And they put him, and then they voted another council, and this council named the president and blah, blah, blah. So, they're trying to concoct something right now, I'm sure, to do this. I don't think the parliament will, be central to this. I'm pretty sure they're going to make, some sort of what would be the word, spontaneous formations, give it a big fancy name and say, these people propose this person, and they'll get their person in now. But I right now, I don't know who it is. Will it be the prime minister, a fellow called Jean-Henri Seyant, who is, talk about opportunist. This guy is the absolute champion of that. He's always been the one who goes wherever the power is. He was supposedly at one point a friend of Aristide, but the minute the Aristide chapter was over, he just switched to the Martelly camp and has been too happy to work with them. So it may go to Seyant, He may play an interim role, a little bit like the predecessor to Jovenel Moïse, a guy called Jocelyn Privert played, and, you know, bring some kind of elections, which, again, the U.S. will try to dominate by and get their people in. So,
well, we know that the U.S. has ratcheted up its involvement in Venezuela. Has, based on this most recent development in Haiti, are they trying to manage that as well?
Yes, I think they're absolutely. I don't have anything solid about that, but I simply know from these decades of experience that they have a situation room somewhere at the embassy and at the State Department, and yeah, they're figuring out how this transition is going to be dealt with. You know, what's the next step? So constitutionally, if the president vacates and the Constitution is now a little fluid because there are really two constitutions, and it's a little unclear which one is predominant. They're contradictory, but it's supposed to be the head of the Supreme Court who comes in. But I think they'll probably go to the Prime Minister. I think that's going to be an easier a bet for them to hold on to the power, because the head of the Supreme Court is, you know, more or less an unknown quantity, whereas Jean-Henri Seyant is definitely somebody who would have no problem at all working with the U.S. government and bringing in whatever transition they see as helpful to them.
So based on your observations and your reporting, what do you think would happen next, or is about to happen in Haiti, especially?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure, and of course it's always dangerous to predict anything in Haiti, especially. But in one way or another, I think within the next few weeks, or at the most couple of months, Jovenel Moïse will announce he's stepping down. And we will see probably Jean-Henri Seyant come in. That's not going to mute anything. Historically, what has happened, again, I could go back to 33 years ago, to the fall of Jean-Claude Duvalier. What they came in with, the U.S. had seen it coming, and they had what they called the CNG, the Conseil National du Gouvernement, the National Council of Government. And it had a couple of generals, and it had a couple of former Duvalierists, and it had a kind of a human rights figure in it. And, you know, they go about it in a very scientific way, give something to pacify everybody. That first government that they rolled out lasted about 2 weeks, as I recall. And then it got reshuffled, and they have another reshuffle. This happened again also in 1956, similar situation after the fall of General Paul Magloire. So we're going to enter into a period of, I think, shuffling. We'll call it a shuffle period. So Seyant will come in. He'll hold the fort for, I don't know, you know, maybe 2 weeks, maybe 2 months, maybe 2 years. But, you know, he'll try to hold the fort. Probably the demonstrations are going to continue, because he's just about as vilified as Jovenel Moïse. He's not going to be able to solve the problem anymore. The IMF is still going to say, hey, you got to raise the gas prices. You got to remove the subsidies on the gas price. So we're going to end up seeing probably he'll fold like a cheap suit as well, and then we'll maybe move into some kind of provisional governments of some sort or another until we have another election. And that will be the interesting part, because right now what's happening, Utrice, is the Haitian left, I can say, is reorganizing. Since the Lavalas Family Party has sort of lost its momentum, and the Petit Dessalines, the Dessalines Children Party of Moïse Jean-Charles, has made many, many faux pas, many, many missteps, and they've always Moïse Jean-Charles, the senator or the former senator who leads it, has just been a terrible judge of character or politically. He's totally reckless, and so has had just betrayal after betrayal, split after split. He looks like he's losing altitude. But there is, I can say, from whether I can't announce it officially, but there has been a real effort to unite the left in some kind of front. Maybe we could call it a Farabundo Marti liberation, an FMLN or an FSLN type of formation that would offer an anti-imperialist, progressive way forward. And, so hopefully we're going to see. It's going to be quite a contest in the next year or two in Haiti.
It's a very interesting set of developments. Always you can look to Haiti for some for some instruction of how people at the grassroots level try to see to their interests and to actually live the meaning of democracy. Thanks, Kim, for being with us today. As always, we rely on your insights. You've been covering Haiti and the region for a long time, and I thank you for being available to us today.
Well, it's always great to have lead stories there, and thank you, Yatrice, for everything you do.
Thank you. We'll take this break and come back and talk about, well, you'll see. Listening to Lead Stories on PRN.FM. I'm Yatrice Lead. Both the White House and Congress know that the shutdown debacle must be resolved. That doesn't mean it's going to be. They just know that it ought to be. But while they're milking the drama, they are astutely avoiding some very serious substantive issues. Who bears responsibility for the shutdown? They're not discussing that. They don't want to affix blame to any one person. They're going on the idea that they're trying to communicate to the public, look, we're all trying to work together to solve this problem. And that is far more important than getting into a potentially fractious process of affixing blame. Was the president acting legally, and constitutionally when he ordered the shutdown? That's a major question. They're talking now about, well, we're busy trying to prevent shutdown 2.0. We're working hard to prevent another shutdown, which means the implication is it is possible there'll be another shutdown. But we haven't resolved, and we haven't even addressed, I don't think, the central question here. So how could the president still. I mean, even though they're trying to get things together, they're trying to fix things, they're trying to see a way out of this preposterous idea of a shutdown. How is it that Congress allowed the president unilaterally to make a decision and take an action contrary to the law that put up to 800,000 people, workers, at financial risk? Now, I keep talking about this almost like an obsession because nobody is discussing this question. And yet, to me, it is at the heart of what we are experiencing as a nation right now. And we have to figure out and we have to address, is this the act of a despot, of a tyrannical despot who believes, as president of the United States, he can do whatever he wants? There's no price to pay. There's no penalty associated with him doing whatever he wants. And the first shutdown was the example. I talked about a guy, a hypothetical guy, wanting some money, goes to the bank, and announces a stick-up and tells the people he wants all the money in the bank and further tells them if he doesn't get it, he'll kill everybody in the bank. Now, that sounds preposterous, but that is exactly what Trump did. He wanted this wall. Okay. Well, you can't want the wall all by yourself. That's not how the country is organized. That's not how our laws are organized. That's not how the decision-making process is organized. And there is a process. The process is it comes before the representatives of the people, and they discuss it in the House and the Senate, with the participation, of course, of the president and his advisors and so forth. And they figure it out from there. But this president woke up one fine and cheery morning and decided this is the day he is going to put 800,000 people in an economic vice all by himself. He's going to do it. Whether they have their workers under contract, which they are, supposedly, and this is the other, I think this is just insane that they allegedly are union members. We haven't heard a word from the unions. We haven't seen a fight from the unions that allegedly represent these workers who immediately and without notice and for no reason were put into major financial distress, and also with regard to their jobs. They didn't know at the time that they were furloughed whether they had another a job to come back to. And this was done with great delight. The president was in his form. He was in peak form. Why? Because he was able to terrorize people who didn't deserve any of it. It's not like they were furloughed because they were found to be underperforming, or they committed some kind of act contrary to what should happen with their jobs, their functions, and so forth. This was not a disciplinary problem. And in one fell swoop, you put 800,000 people and their families in financial jeopardy, and then had the nerve to say, as did the Secretary of Commerce, What's the problem? It's only a mild inconvenience, but there's no need to throw up your hands in despair and act like it's the end of the world. Go next door to your neighbors and ask for some cans of food. Go to a food pantry and get some help, or apply for a loan from a bank to tide you over. It's mind-boggling that this actually happened and the whole nation took it. I seem to be the only person here just about ready to lose a gasket, to blow my gasket over this issue. This is wrong. This is absolute abuse of power. This is illegal. This is unconstitutional. And may I say, this is un-American. Now they're trying to make nice and they're trying to indicate to the public, well, we're working together. I'm not concerned about that. I'm not concerned about that. I'm concerned that something went radically wrong here. The president was able, with the complicity, I suppose I could say, of Congress, to abuse his power and to create such havoc. And mayhem and anxiety and uncertainty in people's lives, because this is the way he solves problems. He has no respect for procedure. He doesn't want to deal with that. He is the owner. The United States is his personal property and everybody living in it. And he can do whatever he wants, whenever he wants, however he wants. And here we are, and the last thing that members of Congress want to do is to discuss and to fix blame. We should never, ever, ever forget or forgive this act by the president. It is the most blatant, un-American act ever that I think a president has ever committed to American people, to American workers. And there is no cause. And at the time that he did this, there was no plan. Just give me the money. I want the money. Well, what is the plan? He doesn't have to talk to Congress. They're not important. The people of the United States are not important. Even his own security advisors are not important. They're telling the president, look, we don't have that kind of an urgent problem with our national security along the borders, as you are depicting. He says, you don't know diddly squat. I know best. So here we are. We've been able to come out of the first round of absolute insanity. And about now, they're telling us, oh, well, we don't know whether we could come up with the second plan in time, because now today was supposed to have been the deadline to have something approximating a plan, and by the latest, on Friday. Trump does not intend to have any kind of negotiation and serious talk and running the country the way a responsible, sane president ought to do. I still think that there should be some disciplinary action and legal action taken against the president. I think in summarily putting 800,000 people's lives at risk, he most certainly abused his authority and his power as president. I think Congress ought to be ashamed of itself because they did nothing. They just sat by and, well, they were wringing their hands and whatnot, which is not a solution. This required a knockdown, drag-out fight. Here is a president acting in dictatorial fashion, making decisions by himself, involving the resources of the country, and looking to illegally utilize the resources of the country so that he can get his way. We're talking, what, $5.7 billion was the price tag at the time. But as I said, even that is a lie, because that does not account for personnel once this so-called wall goes up. You'll need people to patrol the border just the same. You'll need courts to be built to process cases for refugee status. You'll need some place to put people. We see here, in this instance, we have thousands of children separated from their families. This is under Jeff Sessions, the former U.S. Attorney General. Brilliant man with the same heart of stone as his boss. We break up the families. Now they can't find thousands of children. They don't know where they are. And they are assuming no responsibility for that either. But let me get back to the central issue here. We experienced as a nation the act of a despot. We experienced a kind of decision, arbitrary decision, that one would associate with a country being run by an authoritarian type who has no regard, no respect for the rule of law, who doesn't care what the consequences are to his arbitrary actions. We had 800,000 workers who, for no reason whatsoever, had their lives turned upside down arbitrarily and summarily by a president who literally is out of his mind. I've been saying that. He sees it as a logical solution. We see a Congress that permitted this lawlessness, which means that they're accountable as well. And nobody says anything, yet they're on to part two. No. We should have accountability for part one. Who caused this travesty to happen? Who caused people to literally go out of their minds, worrying about how they're going to take care of their families and their financial responsibilities? Who caused it? Because while they were denied a paycheck, several paychecks, as a matter of fact, members of Congress continued to be paid. The president continued to get a check. His children continued to get a check. So what they said in that instance was, well, it's good for the goose, but not good for the gander. Y'all would just have to deal with the inconvenience and the anxiety that we're causing you. But we, in the meantime, we're not suffering. We have no intention of suffering. We're not holding up our paychecks. We're getting paid. We see the union punk out. And all other unions that could have come to the rescue here to restore some degree of sanity and protect the workers, they all punked out. They did not force the hand of this government while it was doing wrong. They did not agitate. They did not say, hey, all our workers are covered by contract. And at least under American labor law, there's supposed to be some sacrosanct appreciation for that. You do not mess with people's bread and butter as a joke, as some kind of leverage that you could use to get what you want. You'll trash 800,000 people's lives. I think we shouldn't go a step further until this question or these questions are answered. And we are clear as to who is to blame for this travesty that we recently experienced. And I say we because it's not just the workers. Any real American would be extremely bothered by what took place here. What's next? They're going to roll up to your house and order you to get in a van and you're never seen again? Are firing squads next? Everybody's acting like they don't have even the faintest memory of what democracy is supposed to look like. And nobody has the courage to rein in a president who is running roughshod over the Constitution, over the law. And we have timid unions who are also part of the problem, refusing to stand up for the people they supposedly represent. So that's where my eyes are fixed. That's where my attention is. I don't care what they come up with in step two, and because now Trump is threatening yet another shutdown. We just finished talking about the people of Haiti. The crisis isn't even occurring. The crisis we discussed isn't even occurring in their country. But in Venezuela, but on the basis of principle and on the memory they have of how important Venezuela was under Hugo Chavez to assisting in the alleviation of distress within Haiti, they're mobilized. They're serious. We have in the United States a bunch of people pretending that they're taking care of business when the biggest question that needs to be answered hasn't been answered. Nobody wants to ask, and nobody wants to point the finger of blame at the person who brought us to that point. and now still is threatening to, put a gun to our heads, the workers' heads, and is being allowed this kind of insanity. Thanks for joining me today. I really appreciate it. We'll see each other tomorrow, right? I hope you would be with us tomorrow as well. Bye-bye.